On this episode of Marketing Mavericks, we talk about Pandora, we talk about RDO, Spotify, the evolution of marketing music today. I guess you'd call it zero to hero. What are musicians doing to get their music out? Stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Marketing Mavericks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This episode of Marketing Mavericks is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. Post your job to 50-plus job boards with one click. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/MM. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MM. Welcome to Marketing Mavericks, where we talk about everything at the intersection of in the internet and marketing. And today, we're going to talk a lot about the industry of music. How has music changed? How are artists creating music? And how are they dealing with publishers, getting to fans, and all of that fun stuff? We're going to talk with Pandora. We're going to talk the agency side of the business. We're also going to talk to a writer for Pando Daily and... yes, we have a pundit in the software business who's also going to talk about his experience in the music industry and what that means for artists and publishers today. Our first guest is Heidi Browning Pearson. She is the Senior Vice President of Strategic Solutions at Pandora. Welcome, Heidi.
Thank you. Hi, everybody.
So I am, of course, you know, as probably most of us who listen to music, a big fan of Pandora. You guys pioneered the space of internet radio and really gave a challenge to traditional radio, including satellite radio. And I'm a big fan. If I was joking around before the show, you probably know everything about my musical interests more than I probably would even want to share. But you guys have, you pioneered the space, right, Heidi?
Yes, absolutely. We pioneered the space through what we call the Music Genome Project. And the idea was, how can we democratize music? How can we deliver a personalized music experience where you're getting endless and effortless discovery and enjoyment of just the music that you love? And we founded our intellectual property, which is the Music Genome Project, over 12 years ago, maybe even 14 years ago. And that is the biggest, the world's biggest taxonomy of music that exists today. And what we've done is we've broken down each and every song at a song level of up to 450 different musicological attributes. And those musicological attributes are then connected to each other. And this is how, when you're listening to your personalized music experience, we're able to transcend across artists, across songs, across genres, to deliver you an experience that's personalized just for what you like. And then each time that you give feedback to Pandora through the, you know, the thumb actions that you provide, you give us signals as to what you like. So it starts with humans who do the analysis. It moves to the music genome algorithm, and then is further shaped by the feedback from yourself and from the crowd. And this is what's created this incredibly unique and personalized experience and created this entirely new way and expectation of people listening to music and discovering new music. And the idea behind it is really to be able to give emerging artists an opportunity to find audience and connect with fans and being heard at the same level playing field as established artists that people are discovering for the first time or rediscovering. And behind all of this is this incredible, incredible amount of data. So to answer your question earlier on, do we know more about you than even you do? Yes, the answer is we do. We have all of this incredible data, and we use that data to make our playlists the best in the world. And we're constantly, constantly working on refining and improving and optimizing those to have the best personalized technology out there. But we're also using that data to provide the most effective advertising experiences out there, and also to provide our artist community with the opportunity to understand their audience, who they are, where they are, and what they're listening to.
You know, a lot has happened since Pandora launched and since Tim Westergren had his idea to change and evolve radio. How has Pandora changed And I've got to say, I was easily one of the first customers in listening to music. I was actually a voice major in college and big passion for music myself. How has Pandora changed since it was originally launched to today, keeping up with a lot of competition in the space, a little different competition, but how has it changed?
So we continue to always refine our listener experience based on the feedback that our listeners give to us, because we want to continue to invest in developing the best product, the best service out there. And we look at a bunch of different metrics. We look at how many new people are adding Pandora and how long are they listening. We look at user growth and user listening metrics to understand the path and the growth trajectory of our brand. And as pioneers of the business, there have been a lot of new entrants that have come into the space over the course of our existence. And we've had, you know, a number of them come in even recently, and we still continue to grow our audience and grow our listening hours, because we've had a very, strong and committed strategy to, you know, the listener first. We've had a committed strategy to making Pandora as easy and ubiquitous as radio. So that meant spending years and years from a business development standpoint, making sure that we're integrated into the Internet of Things to make sure that we are in the connected home, the connected device, the connected car, so that people could enjoy their listening experience whenever they want, wherever they want, and however they want. And now we're really excited because after all these years of integrating into these consumer electronic devices, we're in over 1,000 devices. People are spending a significant amount of time there. We're now integrated in native integrations into automobiles. And that is really the next frontier for us, especially as you start to think of us and our strategy to really redefine the radio world. The car is the last piece of that puzzle to make sure that we're delivering this personalized radio experience.
Well, and many of us already listen to your service, streaming music, in our vehicles through our mobile device. So how is that changing? How are you taking it beyond the mobile device and engaging the automobile industry?
Right. We have over 77 million people who listen to Pandora on a monthly basis. And of that, 80% of them listen through mobile devices or mobile connected devices. And as you can imagine, people have been very savvy early on by using aux jacks to be able to listen to their Pandora while they're in their car. Well, what we're talking about now is the shift to having the actual Pandora be integrated into the head unit of these automotive. So it's a native auto integration. And we work with 26 different auto brands and multiple vehicle or license plates within those brands, to be able to deliver Pandora through the dash, through an in-dash experience. And each and every manufacturer has chosen to take a different approach into how they integrate Pandora. Some have chosen to go down the route of having voice activation, so you can voice activate your stations. Others have embedded thumbs into the actual steering wheel and dash, so you can actually give your thumb signals back while you're driving in a safe manner. So we are excited about the notion that right now 5 million people have activated new cars with Pandora integrated into the system. And when you think about that number, it's pretty remarkable when there are probably 15 million cars that are sold, brand new cars that are sold on a yearly basis. 5 million new models have Pandora already activated in them. And we're just excited on how that's going to grow as more and more models roll off the lot and more people discover that they can activate their Pandora experience in a much more seamless way.
You know, I want to take a step back a little bit because I felt really connected to you when I heard you talking about your personal experience. So we've been talking about this really exciting industry that you're in, and all the changes. And I want to get back to that, but I want to take a step back and talk about literally how you personally got started as a marketer in this business. And by that, I mean just technology in general. When was your first step into working as a marketer in technology?
So my first step in terms of marketing and technology was like many of us when we didn't even have computers in our offices in those days, right? Mm-hmm. And I worked for a company called Kaplan, and it was Kaplan Test Prep. Maybe many of you have taken a test to get into grad school, law school, college, etc. And that was really my first introduction to the power of having computerized technology to assist in marketing. And it goes down to a very, very simple task that we had. We were trying to really understand understand and correlate our advertising efforts to events. How was our advertising investment driving success, whether it was driving people to events or driving people to purchase Kaplan test prep programs? And you always had to rely on the human question. How did you hear about us? And, you know, 9 times out of 10, people say word of mouth. Well, you couldn't actually track back to the advertisements that you had on the radio or on television or in newspapers. And when I got introduced to the clever tracking that the internet afforded, it was that aha moment for me, which is, you mean I never have to ask the question again. I will just know, because the internet has all these tracking capabilities that would allow me to correlate all of my media and marketing investments to real actions. So that was my first love affair, was all through the data. And then from there, I went to one of the first digital agencies in the space, and that was Organic. And that's where I continued to really build that fusion between technology and media and measurement, and really understanding how each of those drives each other. And then through my career, I've had a love for music. And so I've had the great fortune of going between agency life at Organic to MySpace. I was, you know, part of the MySpace trajectory, and then went back into the agency space, worked at a traditional agency, and then came to Pandora. And I love being at that intersection of music and technology and lifestyle, which is exactly where Pandora sits today.
It does. How, so let's, you know, you actually gave a really powerful TED Talk. And so if somebody's listening to this and you want to check that out, I highly recommend it. It's really about just this idea of women and emotional IQ and what that means. And you tell your story about going to work in the business and how some of your insecurities and how you were able to make a difference. Looking back at when you first started to today, what was something that maybe you wish you had done differently in getting started that that you look back as a learning lesson?
That's a really great question. You know, I look at everything, whether it's been a success or a failure, as a learning lesson. I'm always optimizing, always trying to learn on everything that I've learned. I think if I look back into my career and even into my aspirations and dreams, I think it's like having the confidence that you can do anything you want is something that I didn't have at the time. I had the confidence that I could execute the plans ahead of me, and I had the confidence that I had really great ideas, but I didn't have the confidence to say I could step out on my own and start my own business tomorrow, right? I always felt like I needed to go through some sort of process, like the official work process, the official growth trajectory to achieve those goals. And I think today's world is very different. You've got, you know, technology, you've got funding, you've got ideas, you've got all, you know, you've got the global citizens of the world to help shape and help and support you. And I think the young people of today can actually live their dreams and achieve their dreams of, you know, owning businesses, starting nonprofits in a much easier way than in my day when I was just not heard of.
You talked very personal in your TED Talk about the loss of your grandmother and how much of an impact that she had on you and the way that you approach business. And I think, you know, just as a leader in business, you've got some really strong points of view on what makes a good leader. How did your grandmother influence you?
My thank you for pointing that out. My grandmother, first of all, I came from a family of very strong women. Not one, but both of my grandmothers started their own businesses and ran their own businesses in a time when women didn't even wear pants. So this is an incredibly strong background that I've got here. And my grandmother was always focused on the positive. And I feel like that is something that it seems like an obvious thing that we should all focus on, but it's so hard to do at every moment in the moment when you're there. And the things that I learned from her is how to reframe things, situations that come at you. Because you always have this inner voice, right? This inner voice that might cast a little doubt. Can I accomplish that? Can I do that? I've never done that before. But if you reframe it and really break it down, you can accomplish anything by putting a positive outlook on it and a positive attribute and asking yourself the rational questions and challenging yourself to overcome any fear or questions that you might have about yourself. Because the worst thing that you can do is fail and learn and then try again. And so she was always the spirit of positivity. And I've carried that through in pretty much every aspect of what I do, how I engage with people at work, how I engage with people in life. And I just, you know, I think that it's the most underrated quality in the business space, but it's one of the most important because it helps you connect with people. It helps you have empathy for people and with people. And it helps you, you know, maintain your feet on the ground while you've got your head in the sky trying to achieve your dreams.
We as, you know, I'm just going to kind of speak to this gender issue, which women in technology, this has been an ongoing issue. You know, we need more women. We need more women to pursue, you know, marketing is a little easier, I think, but just in technology in general, what would your advice be to the startups out there or the technology leaders in hiring women? And what would your advice be to women who are starting their career and potentially considering getting into the technology space?
So for women, I'd say go for it. Like, there is no better opportunity than now to get involved in it. And if you have a passion for it and a love for it, just like go, you know, go all in on it. Because I think that it's really important that we have a gender balance in terms of perspective. It's, you know, been studied over the course of the years that men and women actually approach problems very differently. And when you have one or more women in a boardroom, a good, you know, change happens. When you have three women in a boardroom, big change happens. And that's because there's a balance. There's a different way people look at problems. There's a different way men and women look at problems. And I think that we need to have more women infused in the system and growing up and, you know, and, you know, achieving higher levels and all the way up into the boardroom to have that sort of balanced conversation, discourse, debate, et cetera, around solving big business problems.
Okay. So I'm going to switch back to the Pandora, and we have lots of questions in the chat room, but I want to talk about the user of Pandora, especially as other services have come about, your competitors in the space and how they're doing things maybe a little differently. Everybody's model is a little bit different. How has the user profile for Pandora changed from launch to today? And is that a profile that you want to maintain?
Could you be more specific about what you mean by the user profile?
So the users of Pandora, maybe the early on users of internet-based radio, what did that demographic look like? And then how does that look today? Has it grown? Are different ages using it? Is it a certain gender? Who's using Pandora today?
Got it. Thank you for that clarification. Yeah, actually, you know, when you're all at almost 80 million people, you're actually transcending across all generations, right, on Pandora. Early on, and still one of our strongest bases are the millennials, that 18 to 34-year-old market. But we also, so we see an incredible usage there. But we've also, especially as we've been integrated into those consumer electronic devices, seen a lot of, you know, people that are over 35, adopting Pandora in some of these higher end technology, you know, implementations. We have Pandora in a refrigerator, for example. We have it, you know, through Blu-ray, through your Samsung, through your auto. So you start to see the growth of Pandora going that direction. But also the teens really love Pandora. They find it as you know, a fantastic way to lean back and listen and discover music that they might not otherwise hear.
So what's next? I mean, again, you've got a lot of competition in the space. I see that you're going to the connected car, which I think makes absolute sense. And it does seem like that's an obvious move for Pandora. What are you seeing as an evolution from the standpoint of how you connect to artists or how you connect artists to fans? What's next?
So we've got a number of really interesting ways that we can connect artists to fans, and that is a big mission of ours. And we actually connect artists and brands and fans together. And we do this by leveraging our incredible data set. We do these programs called Pandora Presents, which are personalized concert series. And we look at the data. We see which artists are trending, who's added their station the most, who's thumbed the most, and we create a concert in that city just for the fans of that artist, just for the people who have that station who have thumbed it. And that gives an artist an opportunity to have an intimate performance with just their favorite fans here in a venue that's really amazing. And there's nothing like the energy and the excitement and enthusiasm that you have when you have an opportunity like that to create your most passionate fans together with an artist. We also have programs in which we, you know, take multiple artists us and pull them together that are loosely connected through the genome. So we have what's called the Discovery Den at South by Southwest and during the holidays, where we look at multiple different artists and genres and connect them together so that people can get a sense of the new music across genre and across artists that they might not have otherwise been exposed to, or celebrate the music that they love. And then we've also been really focused on developing original content in the audio space. When you think about the mobility mindset and the fact that everybody is walking around with a mobile device in their hands and earbuds, it's an earbud culture, right? The earbuds in their ears, they might not always be looking at their screen, but they are listening to Pandora natively. And we want to be able to provide original content, interviews with artists, stories, episodic content stories around artists' lives and careers that we can bring to our fans, because there's that expectation of Pandora's, you know, such a personal, personalized music experience. It's on your most personal device, and there's that expectation of that personal connection to the artist, and we want to facilitate that through, you know, our discovery and through our brand programs that we bring to life.
Well, I've definitely been inspired by listening to you talk just about being a leader, and I think as a woman, that you've got some great advice. Like I mentioned your TED talk before, and I think, you know, when as women are entering this field, it's really important, but it's also important to stay focused on listening to your employees and keeping your employees focused, especially in an industry that changes so much. And I don't mean just music, certainly, but to technology and software. How well do you engage your team with ideas on how to evolve your business? And what's the culture like at Pandora?
The culture at Pandora is, like, by far my favorite thing of all my career in technology and in advertising and in music. This is by far the best culture here, and we take it very, very seriously, and we screen for that before you even join Pandora. You have to fit into our culture, and at the core of it, it's all about collaboration and respect. It's about that balance of confidence and humility, and it's about trusting each other. And through all of those principles, we call them the Pandora principles, we inspire great ideas and great collaboration. As you mentioned, you still have to have focus, but it doesn't mean we stop the ideas. And we've got this long list of, waiting list of all these amazing ideas. And we're taking a surgical approach to focusing on what's the right time and the right idea to execute as we continue to grow and evolve our business and our product.
Do you attend concerts? As a youth you did probably, right? But do you attend concerts today? Do you go to concerts?
I do. I go to all the concerts we throw. We had 29 live music events last year alone.
Wow.
So that's a lot. But I also do attend live concerts outside of that. So yes, it never gets old.
Personal guilty music pleasure. Go.
Well, I love Hall & Oates. I really do. And every now and then, I got to admit, I turn on a little Bee Gees. It's a throwback for me, but it's fun. There's nothing more fun than a little disco.
You know, you have gone up so much further in my book. I mean, Hall & Oates, really? Maneater? Come on. Can't get any better than that.
See? We have a common bond.
I love an 80s girl.
Music brings us together.
It does bring us together. It's funny that Evan Green, I don't know if you know him, he's head of marketing for the Recording Academy, the Grammys, and he's been a frequent guest. He's got a really good insight on how to engage fans. And I think as an event specifically, I mean, they started using social media to really promote their specific event that you have to tune into, right? So you can't see it live streaming. You actually have to watch CBS to see it. And once they started engaging fans over the internet, they saw a 35% increase in Nielsen ratings, 32% of that within tweens. So it was a really important thing that they actually understood how to connect. How does Pandora continue to connect? I mean, obviously, you're a connected software. I mean, you go to Pandora's site, and you mentioned earlier how you can like something and you can share with your friends. How important is that in the growth of Pandora?
It's absolutely paramount. And it was actually one of the principles that Tim Westergren felt very strongly about, which is we will have a personal connection with our listeners. We have an entire team of people called listener support who answer each and every email, tweet, comment that comes in about Pandora, and they have personal relationships. It's amazing to hear back from people who write in how few companies actually take the time to respond and have a dialogue with them. So first and foremost, we're always personal. We use the social levers. We use discovery. We use our email to make sure that we're surfacing what's new music that we think you might like based on the feedback that you've given to us. What are the new opportunities? We use some of our advertising units, our audio advertising units, and our display advertising units to alert you to opportunities like those personalized concert series if you fit the criteria of having, you know, started a station or thumbed up that artist station. So you get an exclusive invitation to that. So we have a number of different communication tools that we use today, as well as where we're, you know, kind of shaping the future through notifications and other social cues to make sure that we're closing the loop and connecting everyone around their experience.
What is your biggest challenge right now? What do you think is, as an industry, is it getting, the managers, producers to understand? Is it connecting artists? Do artists get what's happening? I mean, where do you see the biggest challenge for the industry specifically? Not just Pandora, maybe, but the industry in general?
I think that we're at this tipping point in the industry, right, where people are understanding the power of internet radio, the power of streaming radio, how sizable the audiences are, and they're trying to figure out how does that fit into their traditional marketing and promotional plans. And I think that that is where we are all learning together. We're able to deliver a powerful audience, a targeted audience of your most passionate fans. We're able to deliver the artist community the data back so they can understand that. We're able to connect advertisers with fans and fans with brands. And so I think where we are right now is this interesting place of, you know, how do you bring this into your traditional model? You evolve your tentpole marketing and your points of view around this. And then how do we evolve together to really, you know, push forward on creating these deeper connections?
Well, I am not just a big fan of Pandora, but I'm a big fan of yours, and I really appreciate you taking some time out. I know you've got to get somewhere, but I appreciate you giving us some time today. I'd love to have you come back and talk more about music and the evolution of the changes in the industry and what's happening. Until then, if somebody wants to connect with you, Heidi, what's the best way they can do that?
They can connect with me via Twitter, or you could reach out to me directly at Pandora at hbrowning@pandora.com.
And we will definitely be listening. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
That was Heidi Browning Pearson. So I am a big fan of not just Pandora, but I think she's a really good leader in the space of women and technology. And she's got some great advice. Check out her TED Talk, because I think that you would be remiss not to check that out. Before we get to our next guest, I'm going to go ahead and actually thank our sponsors who sponsor Marketing Mavericks. Without them, we would not be here, which we really appreciate. Our sponsor today is ZipRecruiter. Okay, so are you hiring? Most of the time, businesses definitely are reaching a point where they have to hire somebody or they don't continue to grow. Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? It's a big question for a lot of employers today. With so many job boards, who knows which one will produce the best talent? Well, if you want to fill that position fast with the perfect candidate, you need to post your job on all the job sites, right? Well, now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 50 plus job sites at once with one single click. ZipRecruiter also posts your job on social networks like LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and Google Plus. ZipRecruiter will add your company logo and colors to make your job pages an extension of your business. You can add ultimate users to your account, create an instant job page on your website, and include a company careers page to use as a careers link. Post once and watch the qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter.com will automatically highlight the best candidates. You can screen them, rate them, then hire the right person fast. Try ZipRecruiter and find out why they've been used by over 100,000 businesses. Right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free for a 4-day trial. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/MM. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MM. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Marketing Mavericks. Thank you so much, ZipRecruiter. We definitely appreciate that. And I highly believe in posting to a lot of different sites. I think that you don't always know where that next best candidate is going to come from. All right. Well, our next half of the show, we've got three, actually, really interesting people in the music business. We've got Ted Cohen, who is the managing partner at Tag Strategic. Welcome, Ted.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Absolutely good to have you. We also have Jeffrey Cullen, who is the global manager at Microsoft. Welcome, Jeffrey, return guest of the show.
Hey, Tanya. Hi, everyone. Good to be back.
Welcome back. And David Holmes, who is the East Coast editor at Pando Daily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks all guys for coming to the show. I just want to give a little context. Now, Jeffrey, you've been on the show before. We love having you back. One of our marketing slash music guys, Ted, you're new to the show and you've been in the industry for a long time. How many years now?
I started working on digital in 1982. So this is my 32nd year.
Congratulations. That's you were an infant, apparently, when you started working in music. Right. I mean, you were a toddler, right?
Yep. We ended up, I was working at Warner Records, and Alan Kay, who had invented the mouse and the graphic interface, had joined Atari. And he called my boss up at Warner Records, and he said, when the CD that comes out in 83 starts playing on computers, it might mess with the music industry a bit. not really sure how that turned out.
Yeah, that was maybe a little before my time. But, you know, you've worked with a lot of really cool bands. You've got a long background in just the space in general. How did you get started in the music business? And, you know, let's just go back to the beginning before we even to give some people some context as to how you got started.
Started managing bands in high school. I managed a guy named Eric Carmen all by myself. You know the song?
Yeah, I do.
You know, everybody knows the song. They sing it in the shower. So I managed him in high school. He was a prima donna in training, grew up to be a major prima donna, but went off to college in pre-med at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York, and was in pre-med for about 6 weeks when I found out that Rod Serling was a teacher at the school and went to one of his lectures and switched majors and moved into communications. That led to ending up at Columbia Records and then Warner Records. And I was doing what they called artist development. I'm sorry, I was doing local promotion. But I had a bad habit on the weekend of running away with the bands. And after 2 years of disappearing for 3 or 4 days at a time, they moved me into artist development, which was running away with the bands. And so I met Todd Rundgren, who got me into computers and got me into video, and moved to Boston, met the folks at Advent, which made speakers, but they also made this big screen TV. And in 77, as I mentioned earlier, we went to Chicago for CES, where CES used to be based before it moved to Las Vegas. And Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak walked into our hotel room and offered to trade an Apple One computer for an Advent big screen TV. I got to know them, and then I got to know the Atari folks, and it just started snowballing in terms of what I believed technology could do to enhance fan connection.
And did you make the trade? So, and how'd that turn out for you?
Oh, for me, I don't know who ended up with the computer. I know it's worth about $250,000. I was hanging out with the Advent folks. The guy who had bought Advent, real quick story, is a guy named Peter Sprague. His parents owned National Semiconductor back when Silicon Valley was really Silicon Valley because of chip manufacturing. And he was this very wealthy guy who he liked Aston Martin. So instead of buying the car, he bought the company. He liked Advent speakers, so he bought the company. So we became friends for some strange reason, and he asked me to come to Chicago with him and sort of hang out with them. And I'm sitting in his room, and that's when Jobs and Wozniak walked in. And they literally had an Apple One in a zipper canvas case, and it looked like a bunch of circuit boards. And they said, we need a big screen TV to show color graphics. Can we trade for one of those TVs? So the trade was done between Advent and Steve Jobs. But somebody ended up with that computer, and it's worth a lot more than the TV is today.
So, okay, you now work with disruptive startups in the music space. I've heard you talk.
Just destructive and disruptive. I don't mean, I like disruptive startups. I mean, you know, I met October of 99. I flew up to San Francisco and walked into the conference room at Napster, and on the floor was Sean Fanning and Sean Parker sleeping on the floor. Fanning was using a motorcycle helmet as a pillow. And I had been sent there by the, what they refer to affectionately as the evil Uncle John, who took most of the company from his nephew. And I thought I was coming up there to consult. They thought I was coming up there to be the new CEO. So I stayed in a consulting role from October of 99 until May of 2000 when I joined EMI. So on a Friday, I was working for Napster, and on Saturday, I took over as basic global head of digital business development for EMI. And what was good about it for EMI was we had a mandate where I came in with the ability to do any deal I wanted to do, and we could do them very quickly. And that lasted for about 2 years until iTunes debuted. Before iTunes, it was 3 signatures for me to do a global deal. Because of the success of iTunes, the number of signatures ballooned to 14, which made it really hard to get anything done post iTunes launch.
And, you know, you've evolved through the industry. You've seen lots of changes. I want to get to some of the things that are happening today and what your point of view is on the industry. You've got a lot of great stories. We're going to have you come back and give the whole history of yourself and what you've done, because there's a lot of interesting things I found in Discovery before having you on the show. So some of which I hope to get out of you. So David, okay. You've been writing on, you write for Pando Daily, and you've been writing on music. You're a musician yourself, and you write about the intersection of music and technology and how basically things are really evolving and how important it is for indie artists. So talk about how important it is. You know, Ted was talking about how he got started helping artists, and I think certainly a lot has happened from then to today. Van Halen and Cranberries, love them, but a lot is different today for indie artists. What's different today versus when I was growing up with music?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's much better. You've got people like Steve Albini saying that, and he produced the Pixies and was in the punk band Big Black. You've got people like him who are saying the internet's the best thing to happen to music since punk rock, because now basically anybody can have a worldwide distribution channel for their music. So from that perspective, it's been great. I think one of the big issues that indie artists are grappling with right now are discoverability issues. So, you know, when independent record stores were still, you know, in every city across the country, you would go there, you would have a relationship with the person who would sell you the music, and you would discover all sorts of obscure artists or obscure genres. That's changed to an extent. What they've found is that the streaming music services like Spotify and RDO, to an extent, they benefit the more established artists more than independent artists. Part of that's monetary, for example, because the more plays that you have, the actual higher your per play royalty rate is. So Rihanna will have a higher royalty rate than the Cloud Nothings, for example. But the other issue is that I really think that no one's quite figured out how to take that that human curation that you had prior to the internet, where you'd hear about a band because of an older sibling or somebody at your school or the record store clerk. I think they're still really struggling how to convert that to the digital age for streaming services.
You know, Jeff, you've had a background working not just with RCA Records, Virgin Records. You started your own agency working with Red Bull, which is always been, I think, a really interesting innovator in marketing and trying to engage fans in some very kind of grassroots ways. And today I think of a lot of the ways that we use social media as very grassroots, right? Grassroots kind of marketing. Would you agree with David? I mean, where are indie artists today?
I absolutely agree with David. I think I miss that element of going into a physical record store, mainly just to find out what new artists were happening. And also the thing that was wonderful about physical musical stores, our physical stores, where that was a place to promote local concerts as well, where you could find out about a lot of the up and coming bands. I think there's almost a need for a curation system like that. I mean, one of the things I think missing from big retailers like Amazon is there's no way to really find out, well, who are the new artists that I should be paying attention to if I'm into this type of genre of music. The social web, you know, it's interesting you bring something up, Tanya, because Facebook a couple of years ago said they wanted to be that curator again, and I don't think they've necessarily made steps in that direction. One of the issues might also be they never have really worked with a lot of publishers to clear a lot of music licensing. So it never really has become sort of like the MySpace. And if you think about it, MySpace, the interesting thing about it was there was a lot of music promotion there because they actually did the back end work to clear a lot of publishing. So it was a place where a lot of bands sort of set up shop and ran a lot of their promotion. We haven't seen that too much on Facebook. In fact, Facebook, I think, has really sort of looked for third parties to offer the streaming services, and they act as sort of the tipping point to find these new artists. But there really is no service that really provides that. It almost is yearning for a startup mentality to sort of collect some of the best minds of various genres to get together and sort of talk in sort of these, I guess, in like a chat board-esque manner about like what bands are happening and what bands, you know, to look out for. I think that's the one thing that's very hard is the discoverability angle. And because of that, I think a lot of artists aren't able to really sort of become bigger in a way that they can then support themselves. And we know that that's not really through record sales, but mainly through merchandise and touring and third-party integrations.
You know, Ted, that's exactly what you do with your agency. You work with startups that are trying to make a difference and change things. So I'm going to ask you, since Jeff brought up MySpace, which apparently right. I think Jeff's still using MySpace. I'm not sure. No, I'm just kidding.
No.
Own it, Jeff. What happened to MySpace? Like, what was the downfall of MySpace, Ted?
Well, actually, the downfall of MySpace is what Jeff said. They thought they did right. They decided to create a music service, and they brought a guy named Courtney Holt in, among other people, and Jason Hirshhorn and a few other people. And they went to the labels, and this is as I think I'd already left EMI, and they struck licensing deals to create a MySpace music service, but they gave the labels a seat at the table. And all of a sudden, you had four major label groups that were all telling MySpace how to do it. And so all of a sudden you had the industry running the store, and it wasn't a good outcome. But MySpace did some, I mean, MySpace was great. I met Chris at early on when he started it, and I had one of these great Zelig moments. There's a place in LA called Kate Manolini's. It's a great restaurant down on Wilshire. And I called Chris and I said, let's have lunch. And we meet for lunch. And I said, I really like what you're doing. I know some guys that have some money. Maybe I can help you raise some money to take it to another level. And he goes, that's really nice of you. I'll get back to you on that. And the next morning in the LA Times, it was News Corp buys MySpace. And he called me a couple days later and said, I couldn't tell you, but I really appreciated the offer. I think they did some great stuff. I think the problem with MySpace was that the pages, the artist pages, anybody's page, looked like a collage, looked like Pinterest on acid. I think when Facebook came along, there was something that was really good about the orderly structure of how a page was laid out. So whether you were a band or an individual or a celebrity, people knew how to navigate it. So that was good. What Facebook is doing now, which I have a real problem with, they let people build big followings and all of a sudden then pulled the plug on them. So if you're an artist on Facebook, and I'm going to use hypothetically a band like Linkin Park, they've got like 14 million followers on Facebook. It used to be that their management company, The Collective, could send, you know, or the band could send messages out to all their fans via their Facebook page. Now Facebook is saying, you've got to pay us $25,000 to reach out to those fans. And it's they've kind of put a chokehold on your access to your own audience.
You know, and you bring up an interesting conversation around Facebook. So something, David, I know you've written about and we kind of discussed is this idea about YouTube, for example, who's been all about, you know, fostering unknown talent and trying to help unknown talent get started. What would you say about the YouTube model versus maybe some of the other social networks and how they're working? I mean, is the YouTube model still working, or... I mean, is Facebook broken because they're charging and it's kind of expensive and we don't even know if it's really working? I mean, who's got the right model?
Well, I absolutely agree with Ted about how not just artists, but publishers, brands, everybody has become so reliant now on these promoted posts. And again, you're right. They're the metrics involved in terms of how these posts are performing aren't great. So they don't even know if it's working. So I think YouTube's at a really, really interesting spot right now because, you know, again, historically, YouTube has been a great place for a completely unknown person, a completely independent creator to completely blow up. And they are continuing to do a lot of things to foster and cultivate that talent. An article in the Wall Street Journal last week said that they're in talks with independent creators to provide all sorts of funding in terms of helping them market themselves, which is great. The weird thing about YouTube is that they're also starting this streaming service that is modeled in large part after Spotify, RDO, et cetera. And with that model, they're actually doing, well, we'll see what happens, but they're, you know, I'm sure some of you know, independent labels accused YouTube of basically offering them below market terms, terms that were worse than Spotify, worse than RDO, and then saying if they didn't accept them, they were going to take them off of the regular YouTube platform. Now, the public outcry over that was huge. People I've talked to in the industry say that YouTube is almost certainly going to go back on that. But regardless, it sort of makes you wonder about what YouTube is doing. It's almost like a Jekyll and Hyde situation where you've got YouTube, the larger platform, is very, very good for independent creators, but the streaming service that they're starting, you know, I'm not really so sure.
Okay.
Well, you know,
Jump in, Ted. Absolutely.
Okay. So I had an interesting moment. In 2006, I got invited to speak at the Aspen Institute, which I had no idea what it was. And I was telling a friend I was about to cancel, and they said, "Do you know what Davos is?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Have you ever spoken at Davos?" I said, "Not yet." And they said, "Go speak at Aspen Institute. It's probably as close as you'll ever get." So I go there and I walk into there's a cocktail party on Wednesday night. And I walk in at 6 o'clock and I walk into the room and I turn to Charlie Firestone, the executive director. And I said, "Coffee or dessert?" And he goes, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Am I here to serve coffee or am I here to serve dessert?" Because I look out in the room and the other people attending are Madeleine Albright, Craig Newmark from Craigslist, Reed Hunt from the FCC, Linda Resnick, who owns Palm and Fiji and Blue Diamond Almonds. And he says, "Oh, no, you're the guest of honor. You're here to talk about the transition." I said, "What transition?" He says, "From a distribution economy to an attention economy." And that's the problem we're in right now. The problem we're in is 15 years ago, your goal was to get your music into Best Buy, into Walmart, into Tower Records. Now anyone can get their music distributed. It's all about getting attention. So it is about what we were talking about earlier about curation, about, you know, these influencers. You only have so many Amoeba Records. There's only a few of those stores out there now that really mean something. But there are, you know, some glimmers on the horizon. I mean, while Pandora does a great job, I think Slacker does a better job of curation. There's a new service called Milk. I don't know if anybody's familiar with it, M-I-L-Q. And Milk was started by a guy named Don McKinnon. Don was the guy who created the in-store music service at Starbucks a few years ago, the Hear Music, Burn Your Own CD experiment. And Milk is a curation tool for people to share discovery. So those give me a lot of hope because right now, while everyone has access to an audience, the competition for that audience is fierce.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think especially as artists are discovering how to, you know, get their music out there the first time they're releasing it. Let's talk about somebody who's not a new artist. but who's been out there for a long time. I think 1979 he started, Al Yankovic, Weird Al.
That's such a big story this week. Everybody is talking about that.
Well, and so is what he's doing brilliant? I mean, is it this idea of releasing a song a day to promote his album? Is this something that young artists should pay attention to? Or does this only work because it's Weird Al?
No, but it's a digital. I mean, we talk about digital stunts. So Weird Al does this. You're now going to have 5,000 bands doing it next week. Beyonce dropped her album overnight with no promotion. Now artists tried to do that. You have to use these not as inspiration, not as imitation, because it's not the immediate fix. So everyone's talking about what Al has done, and he's a really smart guy, and he's been very clever, and there's some great articles out there. But you should use that as just something to think about, not to try and imitate. And it's the imitation stuff that drives me crazy, because you will have 5,000 artists next week trying the same thing.
Got to agree with Ted there. I mean, what we have to think about, and what most artists have to think about going forward, and we touched on this when we talked about publishing too, Tanya, is media is the new creative. So when I talk to a lot of strategists who say, what are the best practices for using media? There are none. It's however you want to use it. And we're stuck in an era where we have a lot of people in big business who think they want to move toward an algorithm. They want to move towards scale. And we really don't live in that economy anymore. As Ted noted, it's really an attention economy, which is why you have things like information jamming and culture jamming. Techniques that were used by political groups now are used by marketers to mainly gain attention. And I think the reason that marketers are doing that is because it's almost impossible to be discovered in this day and age, and specifically in music. Because, I mean, if you think about it, there's all these studies on, well, people still find out about music, our new music, through radio. I don't know where those studies are coming from. I think a lot of them are actually done by the broadcasters.
Exactly. I mean,
it's, you know, we have to realize that, you know, media is the new creative. And I think younger bands, I mean, there's a lot of really great things that are done. I mean, what Al Yankovic has done is he's realized, hey, I'm going to use media in any way possible to have people discover my new album. I haven't had a new album out in the market for a very long time. So this is what I'm going to do. I think anyone who tries to imitate that, it's just not going to have the same effect. You have to think about what, you know, who your audience is and how you're going to use media. I think actually the big player won't even be a Facebook or any of these other platforms. I think the big player will be a mobile video platform that maybe is not even up and running, that people will capture artists live and be able to share those with a small circle of friends. I think one of the things I've noticed this past week is a technology out of London called TunePix. You're able to take a picture and then put music to it and share it with your friends. And I said to everyone, this could be bigger than Instagram, because we share emotions that way, but you're also finding out about new artists and music in that manner. And Instagram immediately said, oh, here's how you add music to our photos. Right. So I think these are things, you know, we have to think about in terms of where technology is going. And you have to look at what younger people are doing. And most of them are not using Facebook. They're not using these other platforms we're used to. It's going to come from a mobile video P2P small contextual network, because things are discovered in small groups best. I mean, I think David brought up Steve Albini from Big Black. I was a huge Big Black fan when I was younger because my older brother was a Big Black fan and collected a lot of that punk rock music. And that's all from small circles of people. So we're moving away from the big, large social network to smaller clusters where music, I think, will be discovered. And then from there, it can be, you know, the ones that actually have the a way to break through will always break through, because that's just how good art travels.
Well, and, you know, Ted, I've heard you talk about, you know, telling artists, no, you're not ready. You shouldn't get out there too soon. And David, you've actually talked about this idea around getting, you know, people to refer to you.
I was going to say, no, I agree. And, you know, the funny thing is, because of my music background, I beat the whatever out of my clients, because I treat our clients like baby bands. And when they say they want to go have the big meeting with Comcast or the big meeting with Amazon or the big meeting with Microsoft, it's literally like telling the band, you're not ready to play yet. you still need to rehearse more, whether it's getting their app together, getting their business plan together, their monetization. Everybody's rushing to market. And you talk about I think it was David, we were talking about a big mobile video play. Was that you, David?
That was Jeff.
Yeah. The thing that's interesting about that is if you ask Daniel Graff, who I think currently works at Twitter, he will tell you that he did that 5 years ago with Kite, K-Y-T-E, Kite TV. There've been, you know, when we talk about Pandora being the innovator, they've done an amazing job of bringing it to market. But I think the folks at Music Match would argue that they were doing Pandora 10 years before Pandora. There have been pioneers in the area, and whether it's there's not enough bandwidth or there's not enough, you know, money there to pull it off, for everything that we look at, even the idea of the cloud and cloud music services, back in 2001, there was Music Bank and there was MyPlay that were both offering cloud music storage. And, you know, 10 years later, the cloud comes along from Amazon and Apple and everybody goes, you know, it really takes Steve Jobs to come up with these ideas. So it's not so much that the ideas haven't been out there before. It's going to be the mainstreaming of them.
So I'm going to date myself a little bit here and talk about High Fidelity and how we used to get best advice at the guy at the record store. Yeah,
right.
I remember records. And now, you know, Jeff, you mentioned getting advice from friends. David, you recently wrote about this and the idea of where we get the best advice. Because to your point, Ted, some bands aren't really ready. And to your point, Jeff, we're just getting the advice from our friends. But how do we broaden that spectrum, David?
Well, I think that there's an interesting app that RDO just purchased called Tastemaker X. And they do an interesting job of sort of gamifying credibility around these sort of super influencers. So you could think of it almost like a clout model, except for, in my opinion, if you're providing really, really good music taste, you're providing much more value than just somebody with a high clout score, per se. So I think that that's really interesting. I think that if RDO, I think the challenge, there are a lot of good curation apps, and obviously there are a lot of very good streaming music apps. I think the challenge for everybody has been trying to figure out how to merge those into one experience. Because Spotify, for example, early on, their idea of social curation was just sending every single song that you listen to Facebook. And that is a terrible way to do it. Because you know what? Sometimes I listen to things that I don't want people to know about, you know? So
exactly.
Very, very often, actually. So I think that people are still trying to figure out a way to not only have a good curation model. I think that Tastemaker and RDO, I think that does. But then the next step is definitely integrating it so that it's really seamless into the whole experience of listening to music.
You know, it's...
You know, there's another thing on that thread. You know, there's a big debate going on of what a skip means, you know, what a thumbs down means. Because one of the things when we're using algorithms to figure out people's musical tastes, if a song comes along and I skip it or I thumb it down, am I thumbing it down because I don't like it? Or am I thumbing it down because...
Dun, dun, dun. Thumbing it down. All right. Well, so, okay. Here's the thing I have. I mean, you know, I personally like to use, I use a lot of different music services. I use Pandora. I use Spotify. What I like about Spotify is I can ask for somebody specifically to play. What I don't like is asking for a specific artist and then I get somebody like that person. Where do you think that we need to go with that? I mean, David, I mean, what do you think is more popular? Is it the I like a band that sounds like, or I want this specific artist? Because if we ask for a specific artist, we really aren't expanding our listening genre. But yet, so Pandora's doing a really good job of allowing that to expand. But sometimes I just want to listen to a very specific artist. What say ye, David?
I think it depends on an individual's mood. I also just think it depends on the individual. You know, half of my friends swear by Pandora. Personally, I never use it. I'm like you. I, you know, get recommendations from blogs or what have you, and then I'll just hop on to Spotify and find it that way. I think that What's interesting is that I don't know which one's more popular, but what I think what we had in the early around the time that iTunes and Pandora were both going very strong is you'd have people. It was a symbiotic relationship. People would use Pandora to discover music, and then they would go buy it on iTunes. But digital downloads off iTunes or anywhere else are completely plummeting, and it's actually being replaced by streaming. So I think that a model like what Spotify and RDO are experimenting with, where or especially actually with RDO, the way they have it is you can listen to the radio part for free, and then if you really like a song and you want to listen to it on demand, then they'll say, would you like to pay $10 a month for that experience? So I think that could be a model that works. There's definitely, I think, a symbiotic relationship between the sort of algorithmic serendipitous discovery and then the, you know, on demand, I want to hear this right now.
And I think the freemium idea where there's a free service versus a paid service, we've seen that with a lot of other sites, including LinkedIn, who you can have the free LinkedIn page or you can upgrade to their premium level. We see it with Hulu. We see it with a lot of other services, including Spotify, where I tend to use the free service. Does that mean as a software provider, they're making money on me still? Or is it to their best interest, obviously, to get me as a subscriber to subscribe on? And I've been tempted. So what's the tipping point? I mean, what would you say is the tipping point for users to feel like they see enough value in the service? Like me, I'm just kind of stubborn. I just kind of hold out and say, you know what? I don't need to upgrade. I'm, you know, they're not going to sucker me in. What's the tipping point for these paid services?
I think it's the curation. It really is. It's not music. The access to music is free right now. I mean, YouTube is the biggest music service. The regular YouTube, not the one that they're going to launch, is the largest music service in the world. But it's a really, I have to keep leaning forward. I have to keep picking, what do I want to hear next? What do I want to hear next? And I think the reality is that we've learned most people like to lean back and be entertained. So if you have that balance between the radio product on RDO that we were discussing and the ability then to lean forward and go deeper into an artist and get recommendation and get playlists not necessarily created by Sean Parker or LeBron James, but playlists that are generated either algorithmically from following, you know, some of your activities plus recommendation, then most of the time I just want to listen. I don't want to work at it. And I think anyone that I've shown any of the services to, going back to Rhapsody in 2001, initially they want to play, they know what they want to hear. It's that tipping point when you get to the moment that you're not sure what you want to hear next, where there's that ha, you know, that aha moment, to use Heidi's phrase, of a song comes on that is exactly what you were looking for, but you didn't know you were looking for it.
So it goes back to that same question that I asked before about, you know, and in the chat room, they're talking about renting music versus buying music and kind of this
It's not renting music. It's unfettered access. I mean, that renting music idea is so over the top. Are you renting cable TV? Are you renting radio? I mean, it's if you can hear all the music in the world for $5-$10 a month, whenever you want to hear it on whatever device you're on, that's an incredible value. And to characterize it as, I don't want to rent my music, I want to own it, I'll give you a real quick example. A year ago, I've ripped 10,000 CDs. I had 100,000+ tracks. I went on vacation. I shut my Mac down. I came back. I fired my Mac up. I got the big black X. I went, no big deal. I've got a backup drive. I fired up my Western Digital backup drive. I got a big black X. I lost over 100,000 songs. 10 years ago, I would have killed myself. I turned on Spotify and started thinking of anything I had ripped. Everything was there. So there was, I literally mourned for about 20 minutes and then basically started creating playlists on Spotify.
But that's why things are different today. I mean, I lost all my music too at one point. I lost everything, all my CDs, movies, music, everything. But now so much of that is accessible and we don't really need to have a CD sitting around or a DVD or cassette tape or whatever it is that you had in the day. You don't need to have that. But from the standpoint of where we get our content, is it the free model? Is it, let's look at YouTube. So we talked about YouTube earlier, and I wonder if the YouTube model is broken. In fact, Jeffrey, you and I were talking about someone who's actually been a promoter of YouTube, who now YouTube is suing because she promoted them in helping artists get recognized. And YouTube hasn't really changed a lot. I mean, they do try to help people who, and not just in music, but certainly in a lot of other areas. So talk about that for a second.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's interesting about YouTube is it is a discovery agent of new music, whether people think it is or not. In this case, you had a person who was hawking beauty products, but she would use music and give credit to who the artists were. And many people discovered who those artists were. Now, what they went and did after that, we don't necessarily know. If they went and downloaded those artists on iTunes, or they listened to them through a streaming service. But, you know, publishers always get involved and say, hey, there's a copyright infringement here. And that's usually when things go awry. And in that case, I think, you know, usually what will happen is YouTube will say, oh, well, you know, we thought you got clearance for all of this. That's something that you have to take care of. So in this case, you know, record labels are suing this individual for the fact that she used music that wasn't cleared. I think it's actually short-sighted on behalf of the labels to do that, but you know, they're looking at it in terms of they want clearance. It's a copyright issue, and yes, we're still talking about copyrights in 2014, like we talked about copyrights in 1998 when Napster was around. Like, well, I think we'll always be talking about copyrights, but in this case, you know, people want their fair share of money up front if you're using music. I think that model might have to change down the line too. Again, with you know, companies realizing that there's ways to get their music used, especially in third-party integration, that acts as a discovery mechanism. And there's other ways then to monetize through the sale of music or through third-party licensing, et cetera.
I think it absolutely has to change. Ted, what do you say?
Well, I think artists deserve to be paid. I think songwriters deserve to be paid. There was a lot of resistance to doing deals with YouTube. How candid can my language be on this show?
Keep it family friendly.
Oh, never mind. Okay. So I was interviewing a guy named David Un. David Un at the time was head of strategy and partnerships at Google and was trying to get the YouTube deal done. And I end up doing a lot of interviews at a lot of where I'm the interviewer at a lot of conferences. And I have this policy that I don't give questions out front. But I turned to David just before we were walking out on stage and I said, here's the opening question. Are you going to freak? And he said, I love it. Go for it. So we walk out on stage and I'm introducing him and I said, it's David Un from Google. And I said, David, let's ease into this. I don't want to be too controversial. So I'm going to start with a softball question. Why are you trying to completely screw the music industry? And he says, wow, you know, I love that question. We're not trying to screw the music industry. We're trying to show them that there are more revenue streams than they realize and that the idea of selling people a CD is not the final revenue stream for music. And it was a great conversation. And he ended up getting most of his deals done in the next month. It gave him the opportunity to basically say, you're so focused on selling a silver disc that you're not looking at all the other revenue streams. But when services say to the labels or say to the artists or say to the songwriters or to the publishers, well, you should use our platform for promotion and not worry about making money from us. In some cases, the money that could be made from that platform is the only place they're really going to see a significant revenue. So that's a problem. And there's a balance there. And the point I'm trying to make in my normal long-winded way is neither side is completely right on this. There are new models and there are new ways to make money. But at the same time, you can't basically say, you know, we're your best friend and don't worry about getting money from us. Get money from somebody else. And it's hard when you're seeing the valuations on these companies to, you know, sit back and go, well, wait a minute. Spotify is now worth, you know, $10 billion, which is now more than the value of the music industry. There's something wrong here because Spotify is totally based on the copyrights of the publishers, the labels, the artists, and the writers. So we got to get to a middle ground here, and we're still not there.
So is the middleman the barrier to entry? Have we broken that down? I mean, what would your advice be, Ted, to artists today who have really great music to share and they need to figure out where to go next?
Initially, I can't remember, Duncan Sheik. There is an artist by the name of Duncan Sheik. And I did a panel about the topic we're talking about now back in 2000 in Las Vegas. And I said, how do you feel about people sharing your music and how do you feel about giving your music away? And he said, I have to believe if I'm giving away a couple songs from my new album or I'm letting people share my new single, I can't panic and believe that's the best music I'm ever going to create. He says, I just like to have some kind of a say in this. So I always say I encourage artists, if they're talented, to share their music with as many people as possible in the beginning. But you should have the right to monetize. And that's where I'm the most conflicted guy you're ever going to meet. I can go on for 20 minutes on this, so I'm going to stop. But basically, there's a balance between, you know, this music is free and everybody gets whatever they want, and how do we create the new paradigms going forward? Because we're in this awkward period where everybody's trying to figure out, okay, how do I make a living?
David, what does the industry need to do to stay relevant, based on your opinion?
Well, one point about monetizing, especially off of the streaming music services, that I think is important to make is that I do not know if music or content in general can be as reliant on advertising dollars as it is. I know that everything is, you need to have multiple revenue streams, et cetera. But when you look at the RIA statistics from the first half of this year, the amount of money that Spotify is able to pay for people who actually subscribe to the service, who are willing to pay $10 a month for all the music they would ever want, which is an amazing, amazing bargain. They are able to pay far higher payouts for those streams than they are for the streams of the free users, who that money is basically only supported by ads. So obviously advertisers, you know, there's a ton of money there, and that's going to play a role. But I don't know if this will ever happen, but I just really like to get to a point where people just realize, you know, it's not that painful to pay $10 a month for literally every song in the world. And I think if we get to that point and advertising is still plays a role, I think that the music industry as a whole there'll be much more money to go around.
Okay, David, you've made a compelling argument for the subscription model. And Jeff,
it's really great. You know, I don't mean to reject, but I mean, David, we sit in Starbucks having meetings at $5 a cup of coffee arguing whether all the music you ever want to hear is worth $10 a month. It's insane.
I agree. Convincing me has been difficult, but you are doing a good job. Jeff, what would you say the industry needs to do different as far as a business model?
Well, one of the big areas of the music industry I've always paid attention to, because I was a DJ for many years, is what EDM is doing, or the electronic dance music. And it's everyone thinks it's blown up overnight, but it's really sort of 20 plus years in the making. And the business model there really is many of the producers of the music produce music because they make the majority of their money in live appearances. They get paid a lot of money in live appearances. And even those on the lower end of the spectrum still get paid quite handsomely to go and gig in various clubs. And you have to remember, there's not a band sort of model there. So they're able to keep the money to them for themselves, one or two people at the most. But the interesting thing there is many, I think, of those artists have, you know, music is still important to them in terms of monetizing that angle. And I, you know, agree with David and Ted on that. But I think they've put more emphasis on, and it's a lot like we spoke about in terms of publishing. A writer might write a book and might not necessarily get paid handsomely to write that book. They might get a few dollars here and there. I mean, especially low-end writers. But if they're able to go out and talk and get paid for those speaking engagements, they make a lot of, they could make a lot of money over time. And I think that's where the music model has to think again. And it's something that's very difficult if you're on the publishing or you're on the distribution or you're on the marketing side, is you might not necessarily have a background in merchandising or live events, et cetera. But that's really where the new monetization is going to happen. And it's going to happen whether, you know, the big parts, the big behemoths of the industry have any say or not. Because, again, I believe in the model of, you know, you get in a van, you go out, you play shows, and you can make a living that way. I mean, it's not a glorious or a glamorous, life, but, I do want the world where at least people can create art and survive off of it. I think that's important. I mean, we don't want to bastardize art to the point where it's just seen as something that's, you know, free for other people to enjoy.
This is definitely going to have to be part one of a much bigger conversation. There's no way we can cram all this into an hour. It's unbelievable how much there is to talk about this. And you guys have all been really great sports about hanging in there. And Ted, I wanted to ask you so many questions. We have to have you back, but I have to sneak one in. So Van Halen, you were promoting, yes. Van Halen. What's a really interesting like story about Van Halen that you have? I know. I want to hear it. I can see Jeff going, mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think PG. You were saying keep it family friendly.
Well, as family friendly as possible.
I mean, they were
amazing.
There's
so many that
aren't
probably.
No. They were amazing to work with. Watching them work a room, watching them work radio, watching them work a crowd. They would do things. I think I can tell you the PG version. You can go to my Facebook page and see the photos. I think they're public. We went into a radio station in Seattle in 82. I think it was KISW. And two girls that were friends of the band came along, and we had just met them, picked them up at school. They went to parochial school. And we brought them to the station, and the band's doing the interview at 4:00 in the afternoon. And all of a sudden, the two girls from the parochial school start stripping. It turns out they weren't two girls from a parochial school. They were two strippers from a strip club in Seattle. And the look in the photos, the look on the DJ's face when he realized what was going on, it changed the term afternoon drive. It was a whole other experience.
Yeah, I've been to your Facebook page, Ted. Those are not PG-rated photos. So I'm just saying.
Okay.
You're going to have suddenly a lot of fans on Facebook checking out your pictures. I can't. So can you say here, is it which version of Van Halen do we like? Is it Hagar? Is it David Lee Roth?
It was David Lee Roth. I mean, I like Sammy. I worked with Sammy. I worked with Dave. Sammy's a great guy. Dave, the way that all worked together was phenomenal. And I got into a Twitter fight with Valerie Bertinelli. And then I had the Valerie Bertinelli Twitter followers basically assailing me. Because I really believe she broke the band up, and she was the Yoko Ono of Van Halen, absolutely.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. And so when this came out in an article a couple of years ago, all of a sudden the Valerie Twitter army came after me. It was a lot of—I'd never been attacked on Twitter before. It was a lot of fun.
That's so perfect for you to say that. I have to confess, you know, David, you're too young, and Jeff, you probably too. But Van Halen. David Lee Roth was one of my, was my third album that I owned. So just
it was a great time. I had 6 years with, I went out with them for 6 years, and watching them grow and watching them, you know, just, they literally were in March of 1978, they played the Whiskey. And in September of 1978, they opened for the Rolling Stones at the Orange Bowl. They went from a 300-seat room to 100,000 people and never choked at all, never looked back. They just grew to the size of the audience. It was fantastic.
I know we're out of time, really, but I just have to ask because I think, you know, what makes a band successful? Because there's a lot of great artists that have great music that don't get discovered. And then there's really good, like, bar bands, which I've heard you call Van Halen, I think, a bar band, certainly at one point.
Right.
And they have such a great stage. They did certainly have such a great stage presence. David Lee Roth might be a little crazy, but he really was, an artist from the standpoint of performing. What made them a success?
I think it's this, it's a delicate balance. And I've seen this. I mean, I got to work with you too. I worked with Dire Straits. I worked with Fleetwood Mac for 10 years. I used to refer to that. Am I still with you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I heard a ping. I referred to my job at Warner was to do station wagon tours. I would take bands out on their first tour and then continue to work with them. So my station wagon tours were Fleetwood Mac, Prince, Van Halen, Pretenders, Talking Heads. In the case of all those bands, they take themselves seriously, but they don't take themselves too seriously. They maintain a certain sense of humor about not being, they're not morose about we're the greatest thing that's ever come down the pike. I mean, Van Halen took what they did really seriously in terms of doing great shows, but they were able to laugh at themselves, to have a sense of humor about it. I had an artist, I won't say who he is, maybe on a further show, who I told him he was being a little bit juvenile, and he turned to me and said, "Is that the way you speak to?" And he referred to himself in the third person. And I went, "Real?" I went, "Really? I think we're done." And we were done. I don't have the time or the patience. I mean, historically, I like to work with people that are incredibly talented, but realize that they have to serve their audience and that they have to relate. And so Van Halen, to answer it, Van Halen was probably the most fun I ever had most of the time with my clothes on.
And whoa, wasn't expecting that last little bit of comment there. But it's a good full circle around to what our first guest said, which when I mentioned her TED Talk and she talks about what it's like to be a good leader. And I think just being an artist, when you look at the really successful, whether they're actors or musicians, they have a bit of humility about them, and they really, they know how to connect with their fans and their audience. And those are the people that I respect and that I want to give my money to. That's going to get me to sign up for that premium service for sure. You guys have all been great. I'm super impressed with all of you, and I appreciate your time. And if somebody wants to follow you, you go first, Jeff. What's the best way they can do that?
Sure, you can follow me on Twitter at DJ GEOFFE at DJ Jeffy. Once a DJ, always a DJ. Or you can read my thought leadership on my blog, futuristlab.tumblr.com.
And good luck with all the changes at Microsoft this week. I'm excited to see the evolution of the company.
Thanks.
David, if somebody wants to follow your work and your personal music and the things that you've done, what's the best way they can do that?
Just follow Holmes DM on Twitter, and go to pando.com. Usually write, two things a day there. And then for the music, just follow me on Twitter. I tweet stuff out from time to time.
Yes, he does. And Ted, one of the icons in music that, was so happy to have you come on and tell your story. And we'll definitely have to have you come back and talk more. If somebody wants to follow you, connect with your agency or whatever, what's the best way they can do that?
My Twitter handle is Spinal Tap, and it's at Spinal Tap or at Tag Strategic. And while I've been sitting here, three friend requests have come in on Facebook. Thanks for that, Tanya.
Yeah, well, I do what I can. And the next time we have you back on, we're going to have you talk about why Spinal Tap. So everybody's going to have to tune back into the next show. Thanks, guys, and I appreciate you being a part of the show today.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, all.
Take care.
Well, that wraps up another episode of Marketing Mavericks. You can follow me. Go to my Facebook page. It's pretty G-rated. At Tanya Hall on Facebook, or you can try Barzini. That's Barzhini. Or connect with me on Twitter at Tanya Hall Radio. Use the hashtag Marketing Mavericks. I want to hear what you think about the show. What guests would you like to hear from? What subjects would you like for us to talk about? And what questions would you like for us to answer? And if you're old school, definitely email me. You can go to Marketing Mavericks, actually that's Mavericks at twit.tv. That's Mavericks at twit.tv. And we hope to hear from you very soon. Thanks, everybody. Until next week, talk to you then.
There's a guy named Marty Bandier who runs Sony ATV Publishing. And he called me up one day and he says, I need you to come speak at our publishing convention. And I said, okay. And he flew me in. He goes, do you think you can do 2 hours? And so at roughly about 3 hours and 15 minutes, he goes, can you start wrapping it up now? Because I went, I said, you want more? I can keep going. I've been trying to work on a book for like 3 years and I just can't focus on it. Because every time I tell these stories, people go, have you thought of doing a book? And I go, I don't know. Anyway.
Well, I am super impressed. You got a lot of stories to tell, and I tried to give a teaser for our next show. So we'll have you come back.
What I'd love to do is come back and talk more about the debate. When I said I'm really conflicted on all this, there are so many sides to the issue. I mean, and again, we're off the air now, right?
Well, no, everybody can still hear us. The show has ended, but we're still live. So all of the fans that are paying attention to our live stream are still listening. So,
oh, okay. I was on Pandora's advisory board when I've known Tim since he started what was Savage Beast. And then he called me up one day and I have this thing where I can remember where I was when a lot of things happened. So I'm in LAX at gate 42 at American Airlines, and the phone rings, and it's Tim saying, I'm going to change Savage Beast to this thing called Pandora. I'm going to connect a radio service to the Genome Project. And so I joined the advisory board, and I think Pandora is great, but I think there's a lot of discussion that goes on right now about, you know, is Pandora paying artists enough? And I don't think they are. I think if Tim can make $5-10 million a year, there may be a few more bucks to throw to the artist. And we got to figure out where that is. I mean, you know, there's all sides. Again, I'd like to talk more about, you know, where the tension is between all the different people that are sitting at the table right now.
But I think that's where, you know, that's where this evolution is taking us to. How do artists get paid? What do the software providers that are providing us with this great content, what do they do? I think we're still in a discovery phase. We still don't know what we want to be when we grow up, right?
Right, but even like, I'll tell you, and I'll be public about this. There's a client that I've worked with. There's a service called Lyric Find. And Lyric Find was the first legal lyric service, and it's run by a guy named Daryl Ballantyne and his partner, Mohammed Mutadeen. Daryl walked up to me in Toronto in 2003 and said, can I be your intern at EMI? I'll come down to LA and work for you. He interned for me for 6 months, and I said, what are you going to do when you're done? He says, I'm going to go off and start the world's first legal lyric service. Would you like to be on the board? And I said, yeah, sure, kid, whatever. Yeah, it sounds great. Call me. About 6 months later, I get a package in the mail. It's board papers. I'm joining the board. So I've worked with him now for 10 years and watched him grow this into a multi-million dollar business with no investment from anybody other than like 20 grand from his parents. And it's been really successful. I won't go into the exact economics, but up until this past year, it was a pretty symbiotic relationship with the publishers to get the lyrics rights. We're at a meeting with a major publisher, and I'm sitting at the conference table, and I could do the visual, but I'm sitting sort of on their side of the table. And the publisher suggests new terms that were beyond onerous. I mean, they were just whatever. I moved my chair to the end of the table so I wasn't on either side of the table. And I said, this is the moment where Daryl and Mo fire me from the board and you ask me to leave the room. Are you?
That is the worst.